I'm sorry to disappoint everyone, but this is not going to be a discussion on the trip to North Korea. I'm so pleased and honored to be able to introduce today. I had the good fortune earlier today to introduce my friend Al Gore to an event that we had. And now it's my distinct pleasure to introduce to you someone I've learned so much from, worked with on a very close basis for some 8 years, and then had the double good fortune of serving with his good wife in the United States Senate. So what a team they make. Former President Bill Clinton and present Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It's my pleasure to introduce to you someone who has been so very, very good to the state of Nevada and very, very good for our country, President Bill Clinton.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Senator Reid. Thank you for many things, but especially now for this third Energy Summit. You have been a faithful leader in this fight, and I'm grateful to you. I want to thank John Podesta, the Center for American Progress, and Steve Bing for their support of this, and all the members of President Obama's administration who are here. Secretary Chu, I think, has had to leave, but I saw him earlier this morning. Assistant Secretary Joy, Secretary Solis was here. And I believe that Senator Cantwell and Senator Tamworth, Mayor Villagrosa, General Clark are here, and I want to say a special word of thanks to Boone Pickens for not giving up on natural gas. Now it turns out we got more than we ever dreamed we did. And Al Gore for his long struggle with this. In 1992, when I read Earth in the Balance, and he was referred to as the ozone man in our campaign, he was undeterred. When he went to Kyoto to negotiate the Kyoto Treaty, and the United States Senate voted 95-0 against our joining, even before he got home. The only bill I ever lost before I sent it to Congress. He was undeterred. And when President Obama signs climate change legislation and the United States is an active partner in getting a successor to Kyoto at Copenhagen, nobody will deserve more credit than Al Gore. And I am very grateful. Now, I want to talk today about the theme of the conference, which is climate change and the new economy. I feel very fortunate that we got a new Congress, a new president, and we're going to have climate change legislation. I think it's a good bill. I believe we'll get a good agreement out of Kyoto. I feel very good that one thing that Al was telling me last week when we were talking about our last excellent adventure involving North Korea, I said, are we going to get something on deforestation in Kyoto? He said, yeah, it's going to work. It's going to be fine. And that was good because it wasn't out of Copenhagen. It wasn't part of Kyoto. I think I feel good about that recent study which says that we can capture carbon for a long, long time in more places than we had previously thought. But we are still working on trying to demonstrate to the naysayers that this can be good economics. And when I see all these people at the healthcare meeting screaming down the members of Congress, saying they read something in the New York Post or someplace that convinced them that their child with cerebral palsy was going to lose healthcare, when all I have met for the last 3 years are parents with disabled children who have lost their health care already, it reminds me of all the people who say that this is still not economically feasible, especially not in this economic time. This is a particularly relevant thing here in Nevada, which is one of the top three states in the country for home foreclosures, and where we have seen the loss of, in our country, of almost 7 million jobs since the onset of the recession, and where even before the recession, two-thirds of the American people had incomes after inflation that were lower than they were in January of 2001. So this topic, jobs and a green economy, is, I believe, at the core of how good the bill we get is, how good the Copenhagen Agreement will be, and how much we are going to do. In my foundation's climate change project, we work on a lot of interesting things, including solar thermal power, which we're trying to get into Western India and the deserts in Australia, and a lot of interesting deforestation projects. But I think it is worth remembering that the least sexy topic is where the most jobs are. The American Council for Energy Efficiency says that efficiency investments can provide up to half of the greenhouse gas reductions we need by 2050, lead to substantial net savings for consumers and businesses on the order of $2 trillion by 2050. A recent McKinsey report estimates that if we invest $520 billion, the United States could cut energy in use for heating and generation power by 23%, which, if my memory is right, probably means use coming out of the coal-fired plants by almost 30%. That's more than Canada's total consumption. It will save $1.2 trillion on energy bills if we invest $520 billion. It also might enable us to do some of what Robert Kennedy recently suggested when he said if we close just 22% of our coal plants that are old and almost uniformly quite small, we could save half or more of the emissions coming out of coal plants in the United States, which I do not believe was in the McKinsey calculation. Now, I say all this because while something has been done in a country that just lost 7 million jobs, we're still just playing with this. On balance, every $1 billion we invest in a coal-fired power plant creates 870 jobs, in photovoltaic cells, 1,800 jobs, in solar thermal plants, 1,900 jobs, in wind energy, 3,300 jobs. Every $1 billion spent on building retrofits is 6,000 jobs. I was very grateful for the $18 billion in stimulus money that went to these projects, thanks in no small measure to Senator Reid's leadership. And I think other states can learn a lot about the steps Nevada has taken, investing $13 million in recovery funds to implement retrofits in state buildings, K-12 buildings, energy-efficient lighting and other projects, including a street lighting program like the one that I've had the honor to help Mayor Villagrosa with in Los Angeles. But we are still piddling with this. We have to figure out how to do this on a national scale and show how it can be done on an international scale. Our foundation was asked to help a group called the C40, 40 big cities on six continents, work on building retrofits. Some of them have been wonderful, but ironically, the most comprehensive efforts have been made in the cities that were already the most efficient. The cities that could be making the biggest gain at the lowest investment with the largest numbers of jobs still have a very difficult time focusing on this as compared with what they might do in electric trains or electric cars or solar or wind or tidal energy. So what I would like to ask all of you to do is to think about what we can do to really seriously take this to scale, and in the process, get rid of the terrible job losses we have sustained in this recession. The Center for American Progress just released a report saying that buildings are 40% of our country's emissions. We can cut energy consumption by 20 to 40% through retrofits, which incidentally is our experience in the projects that my foundation's worked on. And that if we commit to retrofit just 40% of our building stock over 10 years, we could create 625,000 sustained jobs. Now, we just had the honor to participate with a lot of other parties in a plan to retrofit the Empire State Building, which was built in 1931 in the teeth of the Depression. As all of you know, it's a very large building. The plan calls for cutting emissions by 38%. It will cut the annual electric bill by $4.5 million. It will cost $33 million. They can, thank God, self-finance, so it'll pay off in 7.5 years, after which the bills will be $4.5 million a year lower forever. A lot of jobs are going to be created, and I think it's the equivalent of taking about 19,000 cars off the road. But it's peanuts. We just lost 7 million jobs. If we want a good bill, we have to convince people that this is an economic winner. If we want China and India in any form or fashion to participate in this, even if they commit to specific actions, not specific targets, whatever the deal finally winds up being, we've got to convince people that this is good economics. And having now struggled with this for a while, I have concluded that the main reason that people argue against this, and parenthetically against solar and wind, is the total absence of parallel financing and the fact that all the costs are up front and the benefits spread out. But, you know, if you want to go borrow the money to finance your own home's retrofits, it's fairly expensive, and you probably can't get a loan for more than a year or two, maybe three at the outside. The best solution of all, clearly, is nationwide decoupling with a requirement that utilities finance this. That's clearly the best solution of all, because then you can pay for it over 20 years. And if you went into not just all the public buildings and all the big buildings, but all the neighborhoods of America and put people to work, if you could pay for it over 20 years, then you could split the savings with the homeowners immediately. Everybody's bill would go down, and the kilowatt hour costs would go up. The second best solution, I think, is the one we were working on before the financial collapse. Before the financial collapse, we had planned to do all the New York City Public Housing Authority, and we're working with big projects all around the world, public and private, to have banks finance these projects longer term, as long as they were guaranteed by one of the big energy service companies, like Johnson Controls or Siemens or Honeywell, so that there would be a backup. Then the utility ratepayer, the homeowner or the building owner, would be in a just say yes position. It would be a very user-friendly thing. You'd come in and do the retrofits. The building owner would be promised that the payments would be no more than they had been before the retrofits. And then as soon as the debt was paid off, the rates would go down. And because the energy service companies guarantee their savings, two good things happen. Number one, you could get the financing. Number two, the savings are always greater than they say they're going to be because they've been guaranteed, and the companies are not in the habit of paying instead of getting paid for the work they do. After the banking collapse, virtually all of that went away. So here's the question. How do we get to the second best alternative now? $520 billion sounds like a huge amount of money, even though we could save $600 billion, to go back to the first study I cited. But the last time I checked, about 2 months ago, the banks of the United States had more than $900 billion in cash today uncommitted to loans, free for loaning. There have been all these articles about how lamentable it is that only 9% of the homes eligible for refinancing under the plan that the president supported have been refinanced, and how some banks find it more economical to foreclose even though the value of the home goes down, and it's terrible for the neighborhood because you get fees when you foreclose and you get fees when you turn around and resell. But why is all this happening? Because people are still reluctant to loan. So what I had hoped would happen, and what I still think should happen in some big states, is that instead of spending the money that people get directly for building retrofits, what if we created a small business loan guarantee program, the equivalent of that, with some cash, so that you could then go to a bank and say, you really ought to renovate the local hospital because Honeywell's standing behind it as the energy service organization, and if somehow they go broke, you've got a guarantee fund standing behind that. The SBA guarantee fund is only capitalized at 1 to 20, and it has never come close to running out of money. If we capitalize this at 1 to 10, for example, if we'd done it for the $18 billion that was appropriated in the stimulus bill, we could have financed $180 billion worth of building retrofits, and you do the math. Instead of 100,000 jobs, you'd had over 1 million jobs. The president says that to get this economy going again, we've got to generate 3.5 million new jobs. The Congress has to worry about the deficit. There are $900 billion in cash in America's banks today available for loans uncommitted. There are all kinds of reasons why that money has not been released, including people worried about the solidity of loans already on the books, having higher loan standards. You know all of it as well as I do. We've got to find a way to unlock that. And so I will say again, my recommendation is that we either try to get some money out of Congress or try to use the money already available to the states to set up an SBA-like loan guarantee program and then get all these energy service corporations back to doing what they do well. In the Empire State Building case, we didn't have to worry about it because Johnson Controls, our energy service company, guaranteed the savings, but they guaranteed it to the owner of the building who was self-financing. You got to get the banks involved in this if you want to quit piddling around. We don't need 625,000 jobs gradually building over for 10 years. We need 3 million more jobs today, and we need to find a way to prove to the American people we can get the 80% reduction by 2050 while growing the economy, not shrinking it. The low-hanging fruit is the simplest but least sexy thing, fixing what we're doing now and becoming more efficient. Now, the third best alternative is to figure out how to fund local initiatives that do the same thing, that all put the consumer in the just say yes position. And I can think of a lot, you know, at Berkeley, and I think one other county in California now is allowing a particular homeowner or a building owner to pay off their retrofits over several years on their property tax burden. Secretary Chu told me this morning they were working on an idea to let people build it into their monthly mortgage payments so that it could convert immediately to a 20-year plan. Nebraska has public power, and there's a man there trying to put together all the contractors with an agreement from the municipally owned utilities that the overall bill won't go up, but since they don't have decoupling, they'll just send the lower electric bill and the contractor's bill monthly at the same time. But in any case, you don't pay more, and there's a just say yes system. You may have other ideas. But I believe that our success in proving there's a new economy out there requires us to do much more quickly on the simpler things. There are all kinds of great ideas. I just read, Paul Hawking just sent me something on the possibility of whole new technology in photovoltaic cells that are virtually organic in their production. I keep reading all these. The guy came up to me 2 days ago and gave me a program on biofuels with a tree I'd never heard of. There's all kinds of things going on. But right now, we need to pick the low-hanging fruit. We've lost 7 million jobs. We got to put these people back to work. And nobody is thinking of this on a scale. It is so simple. So that's my take on it. Let me just offer two other ideas. This cash for clunkers thing has worked better than everybody dreamed it would. Detroit's happy. The dealers don't have cars. It's a big argument for doing exactly the same thing with electric cars. Right now, you just got a $7,500 tax credit that will phase out for buying electric cars in the bill. I think we ought to go to $10,000 in the swap for a couple of years and then go down after that. Get as close to the cash for clunkers as you can. This thing has worked like a dream, maybe because we didn't raise the mileage standards for what you have to buy high enough. But the point is, it proves that the American people will bite if it makes good economic sense. And let me just offer one other thought. This is a global problem, and we have to look for global solutions. And again, sometimes the things that aren't sexy are really important. I have committed myself to spend the next couple of years working in Haiti for the UN to try to facilitate the regeneration of that country, which lost 15% of its GDP in the storms last year. And right now, we're just trying to put people to work, basically cleaning up the waterways and making sure that we don't, if there are new storms in this storm season, we don't have happen what happened last year, which is that 80% of the losses were from water and only 20% from wind, which is exactly the reverse of what typically happens in a hurricane in the United States, for example. But I came across something that is so simple, it's almost laughable, but it will illustrate what I think all of us should be looking for. One of the reasons that Haiti's in a fix it's in is it's had total deforestation. It's had total deforestation because people find it more profitable to cut down trees for charcoal than to leave them up and let the mangoes fall off or let them sink roots and absorb water and become a watershed. So in one very large, heavily populated area of Port-au-Prince, a young man, 27 years old, put together a neighborhood council and decided that at least the least they could do in this very poor, very high unemployment, very high crime neighborhood is make people proud of it again by picking up the garbage and figuring out something to do with it. So he put a lot of people to work picking up the garbage. Then he put other people to work separating the garbage. Then they began to make organic fertilizer, which they're going to provide to the farmers. And they separated the paper from the plastic, from the glass, from the metal. There is no market for going down to Haiti and buying things for recycling right now, but there will be when the economy comes up. What these people did in the neighborhood, I think, is quite interesting. They developed their own machines to shred the paper. Then they make it sopping wet. Then they mixed it with sawdust they got from a local furniture manufacturer for free because the guy was so relieved to have somebody tote his sawdust off. They put it into canisters, and then they put 12 canisters under a handheld press they designed, and they pressed all the water out. Then they sliced it and put the stuff out in the sun to dry, and it produced this. And here's the point I'm trying to make. This briquette is nothing but paper and sawdust. They sell them for a penny a piece. With four of them, you can cook in a pot for 45 minutes. You can cook dinner for 4 cents. That's insignificant to you. But charcoal costs 20 cents. The same heat value of charcoal costs five times as much. If we can develop and sell these things, 10 times to 20 times as many people will be employed than are employed cutting down trees and making charcoal. And the consumer will be able to use this product for one-fifth what it costs to burn the charcoal. And they will have, in effect, systematically reduced the need for landfills, which emit methane gas, and organized all the materials to be recycled. All I have to do is find somebody to find the to buy the plastic to recycle it. If we just do that, we can keep selling these things for a penny. Now, this is boring, right? Not nearly as interesting as the newest developments in solar technology. But 70% of the people of Haiti live on less than $2 a day. It's a big deal to them if they can cut the cost of eating by 80%. It's a big deal to them if they can find an alternative to cutting down trees and making charcoal that employs 10 to 20 times as many people. When we hear about this in a poor country, you think, oh, isn't that interesting? I wonder if it's amazing. We can lose some money if you want to invest in it, by the way. But the point I want to make is, that's what all this energy efficiency is in America. The last thing I'd like to say is we need everybody to raise their building standards. We just recognized that the C40 had its meeting recently in Seoul, Korea, and I went over there and we recognized 16 developments in 10 cities on 5 continents, some commercial, some residential, some mixed, one huge one in London. Every one of them is going to be a zero emission development, not just one building, the whole development. And they'll create more jobs and save lots of money. But let's start in America where the jobs are. Let's take what Nevada's doing and put it on steroids. Let's figure out a way to unlock the $900 billion that's already there before we go get more money from the taxpayers and raise taxes or cut the raise the deficit. Let's give some way for the American financial system and the American enterprise system to begin to work again to prove this is good business. And there's 7 million Americans out there dying to go to work, and that understates the problem because there are millions more who are working less every week than they want to work, and countless numbers of others who aren't in the unemployment numbers because they've given up looking for jobs. So don't be satisfied with doing 40% of our buildings over 10 years. Let's do them all over the next 5 years and put millions of people to work and prove that this is the right thing to do. Thank you, and God bless you.